This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Penguin Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Lords of the Sith, by Paul S. Kemp. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. Chapter 1. Vader completed his meditation and opened his eyes. His pale, flame-savaged face stared back at him from out of the reflective black transparasteel of his pressurized meditation chamber. Without the neural connection to his armor, he was conscious of the stumps of his legs, the ruin of his arms, the perpetual pain in his flesh. He welcomed it. Pain fed his hate, and hate fed his strength. Once, as a Jedi, he had meditated to find peace. Now he meditated to sharpen the edges of his anger. He stared at his reflection a long time. His injuries had deformed his body, left it broken. But they perfected his spirit, strengthening his connection to the Force. Suffering had birthed insight. An automated metal arm held the armor's helmet and faceplate over his head, a doom soon to descend. The eyes of the faceplate, which intimidated so many, were no peer to his unmasked eyes. From within a sea of scars, his gaze simmered with controlled, harnessed fury. The secondary respirator, still attached to him, always attached to him, masked the ruins of his mouth, and the sound of his breathing echoed off the walls. Drawing on the Force, he activated the automated arm. It descended, and the helmet and faceplate wrapped his head in metal and plasteel, the shell in which he existed. He welcomed the spikes of pain when the helmet's neural needles stabbed into the flesh of his skull and the base of his spine, unifying his body, mind, and armor to form an interconnected unit. When man and machine were one, he no longer felt the absence of his legs or arms, the pain of his flesh, but the hate remained, and the rage still burned. Those he never relinquished, and he never felt more connected to the Force than when his fury burned. With an effort of will, he commanded the onboard computer to link the primary respirator to the secondary and to seal the helmet at the neck, encasing him fully. He was home. Once he'd found the armor hateful, foreign, but now he knew better. He realized that he'd always been fated to wear it, just as the Jedi had always been fated to betray their principles. He'd always been fated to face Obi-Wan and fail on Mustafar, and in failing, learn. The armor separated him from the galaxy, from everyone, made him singular, freed him from the needs of the flesh, the concerns of the body that once had plagued him, and allowed him to focus solely on his relationship to the Force. It terrified others, he knew. And that pleased him. Their terror was a tool he used to accomplish his ends. Yoda once had told him that fear led to hate and hate to suffering. But Yoda had been wrong. Fear was a tool used by the strong to cow the weak. Hate was the font of true strength. Suffering was not the result of the rule of the strong over the weak. Order was. By its very existence, the Force mandated the rule of the strong over the weak. The Force mandated order. The Jedi had never seen that, and so they'd misunderstood the Force and been destroyed. But Vader's master saw it. Vader saw it. And so they were strong. and so they ruled. He rose, his breathing loud in his ears, loud in the chamber, his image huge and dark on the reflective wall. A wave of his gauntleted hand and a mental command render the walls of his ovate meditation chamber transparent instead of reflective. The chamber sat in the center of his private quarters aboard the Perilous. He looked out and up through the large viewport that opened out onto the galaxy and its numberless worlds and stars. It was his duty to rule them all. He saw that now. It was the manifest will of the Force. Existence without proper rule was chaos, disorder, suboptimal. The Force, invisible but ubiquitous, bent toward order and was the tool through which order could and must be imposed, but not through harmony, not through peaceful coexistence. That had been the approach of the Jedi, a foolish, failed approach that only fomented more disorder. Vader and his master imposed order the only way it could be imposed, the way the Force required that it be imposed, through conquest. By forcing the disorder to submit to the order, by bending the weak to the will of the strong. The history of Jedi influence in the galaxy was a history of disorder and the sporadic wars disorder bred. The history of the Empire would be one of enforced peace, of imposed order. A pending transmission caused the intercom to chime. He activated it, and a hologram of the aquiline-faced, gray-haired commander of the Perilous, Captain Luit, formed before him.
Lord Vader, there's been an incident at the Yaga Minor shipyards.
What kind of incident, Captain?
The lights from the bridge computers blinked or didn't as dictated by the pulse of the ship and the gestures of the ragtag skeleton crew of freedom fighters who staffed the stations. Jam stood behind the helm and looked alternately from the viewscreen to the scanner as he mentally recited the words he'd long ago etched on the stone of his mind so that he could, as needed, read them and be reminded. Not a terrorist, but a freedom fighter. Not a terrorist, but a freedom fighter. Cham had fought for his people in Ryloth for almost a standard decade. He'd fought for a free Ryloth when the Republic had tried to annex it, and he fought now for a free Ryloth against the Empire that was trying to strip it bare. A free Ryloth. The phrase, the concept, was the pole star around which his existence would forever turn. Because Ryloth was not free. As Cham had feared back during the Clone Wars, one well-intentioned occupier of Ryloth had given way to another less well-intentioned occupier, and a Republic had, through the alchemy of ambition, been transformed into an empire. An Imperial Protectorate, they called Ryloth. On Imperial star charts, Cham's homeworld was listed as free and independent, but the words could only be used that way with irony, else meaning was turned on its head. Because Ryloth was not free. Ornfree Tah, Ryloth's obese representative to the Lickspittle Ceremonial Imperial Senate, validated the otherwise absurd Imperial claims through his treasonous acquiescence to them. But then Ryloth had no shortage of Imperial collaborators, or those willing to lay supine before stormtroopers. And so, Ryloth was not free. But it would be, one day. Cham would see to it. Over the years, he'd recruited and trained hundreds of like-minded people, most, but not all of them, Twi'leks. He'd cultivated friendly contacts and informants across Ryloth's system, established hidden bases, hoarded materiel. Over the years, he'd planned and executed raid after raid against the Imperials, cautious and precise raids, true but effective nevertheless. Dozens of dead Imperials gave mute testimony to the growing effectiveness of the Free Ryloth movement. Not a terrorist, but a freedom fighter. He put a reassuring hand on the shoulder of the helm, felt the tension in the clenched muscles of her shoulder. Like most of the crew, like Cham, she was a Twi'lek, and Cham doubted she'd ever flown anything larger than a little gorge hopper, certainly nothing like the armed freighter she steered now. "Just hold her steady, Helm," Cham said. "We won't need anything fancy out of you." Standing behind Cham, Isval added, "We hope." The helm exhaled and nodded. Her leku, the twin headtails that extended down from the back of her head to her shoulders, relaxed slightly to signify relief.
"Aye, sir. Nothing fancy."
Isval stepped beside Cham, her eyes on the viewscreen.
"Where are they?"
she grumbled, the darkening blue of her skin and the agitated squirm of her leku a reflection of her irritation.
"It's been days and no word."
Isval always grumbled. She was perpetually restless, a wanderer trapped in a cage only she could see, pacing the confines over and over, forever testing the strength of the bars. She reminded him of his daughter Hera, whom he missed deeply when he allowed himself such moments. Cham valued her need for constant motion, for constant action. They were the perfect counterpoints to each other. Her rash, him deliberate. Her practical, him principled.
"Peace, Isval,"
he said softly. He'd often said the same thing to Hera. He held his hands, sweaty with stress despite his calm tone, clasped behind his back. He eyed the bridge data display. Almost time.
"They're not late, not yet. And if they'd failed, we'd have had word by now."
Her retort came fast.
"If they'd succeeded, we'd have had word by now too, wouldn't we?"
Cham shook his head, his leku swaying.
"No, not necessarily. They'd run silent. Pock knows better than to risk calm chatter. He'd need to skim a gas giant to refuel too. And he might have needed to shake pursuit. They had a lot of space to cover." "He would have sent word, though. Something," she insisted. "They could have blown up the ship during the hijack attempt. They could all be dead. Or worse."
She said the words too loudly, and the heads of several of the crew came up from their work, looks of concern on their faces.
"They could, but they're not."
He put his hand on her shoulder.
"Peace, Isval. Peace."
She grimaced and swallowed hard, as if trying to rid herself of a bad taste. She pulled away from him and started to pace anew.
"Peace. There's peace only for the dead."
Cham smiled.
"Then let's stick with war for at least a bit longer, eh?"
His words stopped her in her pacing and elicited one of her half-smiles. And a half-smile was as close as Isval ever got to the real thing. He had only a vague idea of what had been done to her when she'd been enslaved, but he had a firm sense that it must have been awful. She'd come a long way. "Back to it, people," he ordered. "Stay sharp." Silence soon filled all the empty space on the bridge. Hope hung suspended in the quiet. Fragile, brittle, ready to be shattered with the wrong word. The relentless gravity of waiting drew eyes constantly to the data display that showed the time, but still nothing. Cham had stashed the freighter in the rings of one of the system's gas giants. Metal ore in the rock chunks that made up the rings would hide the ship from any scans.
"Helm, take us above the plane of the rings," Cham said.
Even in an off-the-chart system, it was a risk to put the freighter outside the shelter of the planet's rings. The ship's credentials wouldn't hold up to a full Imperial query. And Imperial probes and scouts were everywhere as the Emperor tried to firm up his grip on the galaxy and quell any hotspots. If they were noticed, they'd have to run. "Magnify screen when we're clear." Even magnified, the screen would show far less than long-range sensors, but Cham needed to see for himself,
not stare at readouts. Isfald paced beside him. The ship shifted up out of the bands of ice and rock, and the magnified image on the screen showed the outer system, where a single distant planetoid of uninhabited rock orbited the system's dim star, and countless stars beyond blinked in the dark. A nebula, light years away to starboard, painted a slice of space the color of blood. Cham stared at the screen as if he could pull his comrades through hyperspace by sheer force of will. Assuming they'd even be able to jump. The whole operation had been a huge risk, but Cham had thought it worthwhile to secure more heavy weapons and force the Empire to divert some resources away from Ryloth. Two, he'd wanted to make a stronger statement. Send an unmistakable message that at least some of the Twi'leks of Ryloth would not quietly accept Imperial rule. He'd wanted to be the spark that started a fire across the galaxy. "Come on, Pok," he whispered, the involuntary twitch of his Leku betraying his stress. He'd known Pok for years and called him friend. Isval muttered under her breath, a steady flood of Twi'lek expletives. Cham watched the data display as the appointed time arrived and passed, taking the hopes of the crew with it. Heavy sighs and slack Leku all around. "Patience, people," Cham said softly. "We wait. We keep waiting until we know." "We wait," Isval affirmed with a nod. She paced the deck, staring at the viewscreen as if daring it to keep showing her something she didn't want to see. The moment stretched. The crew shifted in their seats, shared surreptitious looks of disappointment. Cham had to work to unclench his jaw. The engineer on scan duty broke the spell.
"I've got something," she said.
Cham and Isval fairly sprinted over to the scanner. All eyes watched them.
"It's a ship,"
the engineer said. A satisfied, relieved rustle moved through the bridge crew. Cham could almost hear the smiles. He eyed the readout. "That's an Imperial transport," he said.
"That's our Imperial transport," Isval said.
A few members of the bridge crew gave a muted cheer.
"Stay on station, people," Cham said, but he could not shake his grin.
"Coming through now," the engineer said.
"It's them, sir! It's them! They're hailing us!"
"On speaker," Cham said. "Meanwhile, alert the offload team. We'll want to get those weapons aboard and destroy that ship as soon as..."
A crackle of static and then Puck's strained voice.
"Get clear of here right now! Just go!"
"Pok?"
Cham said, as the crew's elation shifted to concern.
"Pok, what is it?"
"It's Vader, Cham. Get out of here now! We thought we'd lost the pursuit. We've been jumping through systems to throw them off. I thought we'd lost them, but they're still on us. Go, Cham!"
The engineer looked up at Cham, her lavender skin flushing to dark blue at the cheeks.
"There are more ships coming out of hyperspace, sir. More than a dozen, all small."
Her voice tightened as she said,
"V-wings, probably. Maybe interceptors."
Cham and Isval cursed as one.
"Get on station, people!"
Cham ordered. Vader's customized Eta interceptor led the starfighter squadron as the star-lined tunnel of hyperspace gave way to the black of ordinary space. A quick scan allowed him to locate the hijacked weapons transport, which they'd been pursuing through several systems as it tried to work its way out to the rim. The squadron disengaged from their hyperspace rings. The heavily armed transport showed slight blaster damage along the aft hull near the three engines, behind the bloated center of the cargo bay.
"Attack formation,"
Vader ordered, and the pilots and the rest of the squad acknowledged the command and fell into formation. Concerned that the hijackers might have dropped out of hyperspace to lure the squadron into an ambush, he ran a quick scan of the entire system.
The interceptor's sensor array was not the most sensitive, but it showed only a pair of huge ringed gas giants, each with a score or more of moons, an asteroid belt between the planets and the system's star, and a few planetoids at the outside of the system. Otherwise, the system was an uninhabited backwater.
Scans show no other ships in the system.
Confirmed,
the squadron commander replied. The voice of one of the pilots carried over the comm.
They're powering up for another jump, Lord Vader.
Follow my lead.
Vader ordered, and accelerated to attack speed.
Do not allow them to jump again.
The V-Wings and Vader's interceptor were far faster and more maneuverable than the transport and closed on it rapidly, devouring the space between. Vader did not bother consulting his instrumentation. He fell into the Force, flying by feel as he always did. Even before the interceptor and the V-Wings closed to within blaster range, one of the freighter's engines burped a gout of blue flame and burned out. The hijackers had overtaxed the transport in their escape attempt.
I want the shields down and the remaining two engines disabled.
Disabling the engines would prevent another hyperspace jump.
Do not destroy that ship.
The heavier armaments of the transport had a longer range than the interceptor and V-Wing's blasters and opened up before the starfighters got within blaster range.
Weapons are hot. Go evasive,
said the squadron leader as the transport's automated gun turrets filled the space between the ships with green lines. The starfighter squadron veered apart, twisting and diving. Vader felt as much as saw the transport's blasters.
He cut left, then hard right, then dived a few degrees down, still closing on the transport.
One of the V-Wings to his left caught a green line. Its wing fragmented, and it went spinning and flaming off into the system. The larger, crude, swivel-mounted gun bubbles on either side of the transport's midline swung around and opened fire, fat pulses of red plasma.
Widen your spacing,
the squadron commander said over the comm.
Spacing!
A burst of red plasma caught one of the V-Wings squarely and vaporized it.
Focus your fire on the aft shields,
Vader said, his interceptor wheeling and spinning, sliding between the red and the green until he was within range. He fired, and his blasters sent twin beams of plasma into the aft shields. He angled the shot to maximize deflection. He did not want to pierce them and damage the ship, just drain them and bring them down. The rest of the squadron did the same, hitting the transport from multiple angles. The transport bucked under the onslaught, the shields flaring under the energy load and visibly weakening with each shot. The entire squad overtook and passed the freighter, the green and red shots of its weapons chasing them along.
Maintain spacing, stay evasive, and swing around for another pass,
the squadron commander ordered.
Split squadron and come underneath.
The squadron ships peeled right and left, circling back and down, and set themselves on another intercept vector. Vader decelerated enough to fall back to the rear.
Bring the shields down on this pass, Commander. I have something in mind.
Talk had left the channel open so Cham and his crew could hear the activity aboard the hijacked freighter's bridge. Talk barking orders, someone calling the attack vectors of the V-Wings, the boom of blaster fire on shields.
Talk,
Cham said. We can help.
No,
Talk said.
We're already down one engine. We can't power up yet. And there's a Star Destroyer somewhere behind these V-Wings. There's nothing you can do for us, Cham.
To one of his crew, Puck shouted,
get the hyperdrive back online!
An explosion sent a crackle of static and a scream of feedback along the channel.
Shields at 10%!
Someone on Puck's bridge called out.
Hyperdrive still non-operational,
said someone else. Isfel grabbed Cham by the arm hard enough for it to hurt. She spoke in a low, harsh voice.
We have to help them.
But Cham didn't see how they could. If he left the shelter of the rings, the V-wings or interceptors or whatever they were would pick them up on scan. And Cham had no illusions about the ability of his helm or his ship should they be discovered. No, Cham said to the helm. Stay put. Vader watched the transport go hard to port, taking an angle that would allow both of the midline weapons bubbles to fire on the approaching starfighters. As soon as they entered the transport's range, the automated turrets and gun bubbles opened fire, filling space with beams of superheated plasma. The V-wings swooped and twisted and dodged, spiraling through the net of green and red energy. Vader, lingering behind, piloted his ship between the bolts, above them, below them. A third V-wing caught a shot from a gun turret and exploded, debris peppering Vader's cockpit canopy as he flew through the flames. When the V-wings got within range, they opened fire, and the freighter's shields fell almost immediately.
Shields down, Lord Vader,
the squadron leader reported.
I'll take the engines. Destroy the turrets on the starboard side midline gun bubble.
The pilots of his squadron, selected for their piloting excellence and a demonstrated record of kills, did exactly as he'd ordered. Small explosions lit up the hull, and the gun emplacements disappeared in flowers of fire. The transport shook from the impact as the V-wing swooped past it, up, and started to circle back around. Meanwhile, Vader veered to his left and down, locked onto the engines, and fired once. Twice. Explosions rocked the transport aft, and chunks of both engines spun off into space. Secondary explosions rocked the vessel, but it otherwise remained intact. Vader slowed still more, trailing the transport.
She's running on inertia now, sir, said the squadron commander. When the Perilous arrives, she can track to the transport into one of her bays.
I have no intention of leaving the hijackers aboard the ship that long.
He knew the hijackers would try to blow the ship, and there were enough weapons in the cargo bay to do just that.
I'm going to board her.
Sir, the docking clamp on that ship is too damaged, and there's no landing bay.
I am aware of that, Commander.
The sole remaining gun bubble, operated by one of the hijackers, swung around and opened fire on Vader's ship. Still using the Force to guide him, Vader slung his ship side to side, up and down, staying just ahead of the blaster fire as he headed straight for the bubble. He could see the gunner inside the transparent canopy, feel his presence, insignificant and small, through the web of the Force.
Sir!
The commander said, as the V-Wing squadron circled back around, but Vader did not acknowledge him. Vader hit a switch and depressurized the interceptor's cockpit, his armor shielding him from the vacuum. Then, as he neared the transport's midline, still swinging his ship left and right to dodge the incoming fire, he selected a spot on the transport adjacent to the gun bubble and, using the Force, took a firm mental hold on it. His interceptor streaked toward the gun bubble, aimed directly at it. Content with the trajectory, he unstrapped himself, overrode the interceptor's safeties, threw open the cockpit hatch, and ejected into space. Immediately, he was spinning in the zero-G, the ship and stars alternating positions with rapidity. Yet he kept his mental hold on the airlock handle, and his armor, sealed and pressurized, sustained him in the vacuum. The respirator was loud in his ears. His ship slammed into the gun bubble and the transport, the inability of the vacuum to transmit sound causing the collision to occur in eerie silence. Fire flared for a moment, but only a moment, before the vacuum extinguished it. Chunks of debris exploded outward into space, and the transport lurched. A great boom sounded through the connection. Alarms wailed, and Pock's bridge exploded in a cacophony of competing conversations. Pock, what just happened? Cham asked. Are you all right?
We had a collision. We're all right. Get me status on the damage.
Pock said to someone on his bridge.
Get someone over there now! Sir! Sir!
The squadron commander called, his voice frantic in Vader's helmet comm.
Lord Vader! What's happening, sir?
Vader's voice was calm.
I'm docking with the transport commander.
Using the Force, Vader stopped his rotation and reeled himself in toward the large, jagged, smoking hole his interceptor had torn in the transport's hull. Loose hoses and electrical lines dangled from the edges of the opening, leaking gases and shooting sparks into space. A portion of the ship's wing had survived the impact and was lodged in the bulkhead. The rest had been vaporized on impact. Vader pulled himself through the destruction until he stood in the remains of a depressurized corridor. Chunks of metal and electronics littered the torn deck, the whole of it smoking from the heat of impact. The V-wings buzzed past the transport, visible through the hole in the bulkhead.
Sir!
Said the squadron commander.
All is under control, Commander.
Several members of the fighter squadron whispered awed oaths into their comms.
Maintain calm discipline!
The squadron leader barked, though Vader could hear the disbelief in his tone too.
My lord, there are dozens of hijackers aboard that transport!
Not for much longer, Commander. You are on escort duty now. I will notify you if anything else is required.
A pause, then.
Of course, sir.
The transport's automatic safeties had sealed off the corridor with a blast door, but he knew the codes to override them. He strode through the ruin and entered the code. The huge door slid open and pressurized air from the hall beyond poured out with a hiss. He stepped through and resealed the door behind him. A few more taps on a wall comp and he'd repressurized the hall. The shrill sound of the transport's hull breach alarm wailed from wall speakers. A hatch on the far side of the hall slid open to reveal a purple-skinned Twi'lek man in makeshift armor. Seeing Vader, the Twi'lek's headtails twitched, his eyes widened in surprise, and he grabbed for the blaster at his belt. By the time the Twi'lek had the blaster drawn and the trigger pulled, Vader had his lightsaber in hand and ignited. He deflected the blaster shot into the wall, raised his offhand, and with it reached out with the Force. He made a pincer motion with his two fingers, using the Force to squeeze closed the Twi'lek's trachea. The Twi'lek pawed frantically at his throat as Vader's power lifted him off the deck, but to his credit, he held on to his weapon. And gagging, dying, he managed to aim and fire his blaster at Vader again and again. Vader simply held his grip on the alien's throat while casually deflecting the blasts into the bulkhead with his lightsaber. Then, not wanting to waste time, he moved his raised hand left and then right, using the Force to smash the Twi'lek into the bulkhead. The impact's shattered bone. And Vader let the body fall to the deck. A voice carried over a comlink on the Twi'lek's belt.
Timo! Timo! What is going on there? Do you copy? Can you hear me?
Vader deactivated his lightsaber, picked up the comlink, opened the channel, and let the sound of his respirator carry over the connection.
Who is that?
Vader answered only with his breathing.
Timo! Is that you? Are you all right?
I'm coming for you now.
He crushed the communicator in his fist, reignited his lightsaber, stepped over the dead Twi'lek, and strode into the corridor beyond. Chapter 2 Cham and Isval shared a look of alarm. They'd heard the communication through the open channel. They knew the sound of the respirator.
What's that?
Isval asked.
Vader, Cham said. Had to be.
Pock.
I agree, Pock said. But had to be Vader.
They knew Vader by reputation. Silence weighed heavy on the bridge.
What do we know?
Cham asked Isfahl in a whisper. She shook her head, her Leku squirming in agitation.
Not much. Second and third-hand stories. I've heard that the regular officers hate him, but the Stormtrooper Corps almost worships him.
How did he get aboard Pock's ship?
Isfahl shrugged. She wasn't pacing. A bad sign.
They say he can do things no being should be able to do. Everyone is terrified of him. This is bad, Cham.
I know.
Cham's eyes followed hers to the viewscreen. They couldn't see the hijacked freighter, of course, but Cham could imagine it in his mind's eye. And now he imagined Vader aboard it.
Situation, Pock.
For a moment, Pock didn't answer. Perhaps his attention was on something else. Then...
Engines are dead, Cham. Weapons are destroyed. We're boarded somehow. You heard.
How did he board? Cham asked. Is he alone?
I don't know,
Pock said. Then to someone on the bridge he added,
I need that information now.
Then, Cham, there are 26 of us here. We can fight. Make them pay, at least.
Pock,
Cham began, but Pock spared him the need to say it.
Don't worry. We won't be taken. My crew knew the risks when they volunteered for this. Unfortunately, I can't self-destruct with the engines offline, but I've got a team of my best on the way to the cargo hold. We can use the weapons there as a failsafe. What? Hold, Cham.
Some background chatter that Cham could not make out, then Pock's voice.
Well, raise them! Raise them right now!
A pause. Then someone in the background said,
They're not responding, Pock!
Cham muted the comm and said to his engineer,
Keep us hidden and tell me instantly if any of those V-Wings so much as heads in our direction.
Cham knew V-Wings had little in the way of long-distance sensors, but he had moved the freighter to the edge of the rings. Even the V-Wings would pick it up if they got close enough.
Yes, sir, the engineer said. They look like they're holding formation around the weapons transport.
We can't just let him kill himself,
Isfahl said to Cham, her voice tense.
Let's get out there and help them. We can fight our way out.
They're dead in space,
Cham said, and instantly regretted his choice of words.
Cham!
Cham ignored her and unmuted the connection.
Pock!
Pock cleared his throat. His bridge was quiet.
I've lost the team I sent to the hold, Cham. I don't know what. They're not answering their comms. Vader must have intercepted them.
Cham clenched a fist but kept his calm.
Understood.
Isfahl spoke through clenched teeth, slow for emphasis.
We should help them.
Cham muted the connection and whirled on her, the thread of his patience finally snapping.
Help them how, Isfahl? They're without engines and surrounded. Even if we could destroy every V-Wing, and you know we can't, it would take time to get them from their ship to ours. There's a Star Destroyer on the way, and some man is aboard who managed single-handedly to wipe out a group of Pock's best people.
She held her ground in the face of his outburst. The rest of the crew buried their faces in their stations.
Vader's not a man, she said tightly.
Not from what I've heard.
Yes, he is,
Cham said, loud enough for the entire bridge crew to hear him.
He has to be.
But there's nothing we can do to help that won't end with all of us dead too. Pock knows it. They all know it.
And we all know it.
He sagged and looked back at the viewscreen.
We don't like it, but we all know it.
Pock's voice came over the comm.
Cham is right, everyone. We knew the risks. We took them willingly.
Cham cursed. He thought he'd muted the connection.
Pock,
I'm sorry.
Emotion choked his voice.
I thought...
I know,
Puck said and chuckled. Actually chuckled.
Is that Isval over there?
It is, Puck, she said.
Still blowing in like a sandstorm, I see. That's good. I'm glad we got to say goodbye. You keep Cham on course, all right? He's too damn principled for his own good.
It doesn't have to be goodbye, Isval said and stared at Cham.
It does, and it is. We'll see if we can't kill this Vader first, though. I've got an ambush set up.
Someone on Pock's bridge crew said,
Blaster fire in the main corridor off the bridge, sir!
For a moment, no one spoke on either bridge. Long moments passed. Then there was some talk on Pock's bridge in the background. Cham could not make it out.
Situation?
Pock asked someone in his bridge crew.
No one is answering the comm,
came the reply.
How can... There were 8 men waiting for him! What is going on out there? Bridge lift is coming up!
Another member of Pock's crew said. Pock spoke into the comm, his breathing audible over the connection, as if he was leaning in close.
Cham will kill Vader and blow the ship. No one will get taken alive.
Pock,
Cham began.
It's been an honor.
Keep up the fight. All of you.
Someone on Pock's bridge shouted,
For a free Ryloth!
For a free Ryloth!
And the rest of the bridge crew echoed the cry. Isval was gripping Cham's arm so hard his hand was growing numb. He stared at the open comm as if it held some secret meaning, some hidden thing he could discern that would save Pock and everyone else. But there was nothing. The rest of his crew sat in silence at their stations, heads down, listening.
It's opening,
said someone on Pock's bridge.
A burst of blaster fire carried across the connection, but only for a moment, before falling silent.
There's no one,
said a voice.
The lift's empty. Check it,
Pock ordered.
He's still aboard somewhere.
A sizzle and hum sounded. Shouts, a thump, repeated blaster fire, a prolonged thrum, rising and falling, a series of shouts and screams.
Pock! Isval cried. Pock!
Cham cursed.
What's happening over there? Isval asked. What's that sound?
The rising thrum dredged memories from the back of Cham's mind.
It's a lightsaber,
he said. The sound of the blade had been seared into his head during the Clone Wars when Jedi had wielded them. Jedi doing things like Vader that no ordinary being could do. But there were no more Jedi and there was no more Republic. There was only Vader and the Empire. Another thump. Then another. More alarmed shouts.
Only 2 or 3 blasters were firing. And in the relative quiet, another sound came over the comm.
Breathing. Loud. As though amplified through a speaker or respirator.
Vader's breathing.
What is that? Is that Vader?
Isval asked, her own breath coming rapidly.
Cham hurriedly muted the connection on his end.
More shouts, the crash of something heavy, and still the hum of the lightsaber rising and falling.
For Ryloth!
Hawk shouted, and the sound of rapid blaster fire filled the comm. The hum of the lightsaber rose and fell, and Cham imagined Vader deflecting the blaster shots with the blade. He'd seen it before. Abruptly, the shot stopped. A strangled gasp came over the comm.
Pock, choking.
He's strangling him,
Isval said. The choking went on for seconds that felt like hours. Vader's amplified breathing, the counterpoint to Pock's dying gasps. Cham knew he should cut the connection, but he couldn't. Cutting it would feel like abandoning Pock a second time.
Tell me what I want to know,
said a deep voice. Vader's voice.
And your death will be easier.
They heard a pained gasp and a deep inhalation, followed by Pock cursing Vader and Tulakai.
Very well.
Pock gagged again, gasped, and went silent. Then a thump sounded, something heavy but soft falling to the deck. Isfal screamed a curse. Cham's heart was a hammer on his ribs, but he said nothing. There was nothing to be said. The only sound was Vader's breathing carrying over the calm.
Cut it off, Cham!
Isfal said. Cham stared at the calm, open but muted on Cham's end. Vader's breathing grew louder as if he had picked up the calm to study it or hold it close to his face. The breathing. The breathing.
Cut it, Cham!
Isfal said. Cham realized he was holding his breath. He seemed unable to breathe. There was only Vader's respiration, regular as a pendulum, loud, ominous. Cham finally got a hold of himself and exhaled, thinking of Pock, the awful gasps that had been the last sounds his friend had made.
Your allies are dead.
Isfal slammed her hand on the comm, cutting it short. Silence.
Cham, we should go, she said. Right now.
But Cham knew it was already too late. If they tried to flee the system now, they'd end up exactly as had Pock and his crew, pursued, caught, and executed. When he made no reply, Isfal said to the helm,
take us out of here.
That brought Cham around.
Belay that!
To Isfal, he said softly,
it's too late for that. They'll see us. The V-wings are spreading out, sir,
the engineer reported.
They look like they're starting a sweep. Another ship is coming into the system.
A Star Destroyer!
The air went out of everyone all at once. All eyes fell on Cham. They were waiting for orders, waiting for salvation. Pock was gone, the spell was broken, and Cham did not hesitate.
Take us deep in the rings. Make us a rock helm. Minimal life support. Take everything else down.
We float.
If we go dark, we won't be able to run if they detect us,
Isfal said.
By the time we get the engines back online... There's no running, Isfal,
Cham said matter-of-factly.
We hide or we die.
Do it, helm. The helm nodded and did as she was ordered. The ship descended deep into the rings, and the viewscreen filled with pockmarked, irregular blocks of ice and stone, all spinning and whirling.
Power us down, Cham ordered.
Aye, sir,
the engineer said, and the bridge lights and viewscreen went dark. Dim auxiliary lights cast the bridge in a faint orange glow. The shadowed faces of the crew looked at one another, at the ceiling, the bulkheads. Bits of ice and rock ticked against the hull. With life support at minimum, the temperature started to drop quickly, but it wouldn't get life-threatening, merely uncomfortable. Cham was more worried about the ship taking a high-speed impact from one of the larger rocks or ice chunks. The hull could take a beating, but it wasn't impregnable, and if the ship started bouncing around in the rings, he'd have no choice but to fire up the engines.
Steady now, people, he said.
Some of the crew bowed their heads. Others stared at the blank viewscreen. The tension was worse than the cold. Within a few minutes, Cham could see his breath in the air. He tried not to shiver. He walked from crew person, touching shoulders, backs, whispering for them to be at ease. He eventually circled back to Isfal and spoke to her quietly.
I should have cut that comm sooner. I put us at risk.
Isfal did him the credit of not denying his error.
Let's hope you get a chance to do so again. That was hard to hear. Yes, she said. This is the last time we hide from Vader,
Cham told her. She looked him full in the face and nodded agreement. An impact shook the ship and the crew exclaimed as one. The helm nearly lost her seat, but used her instrument panel to stay at her station. There were no follow-up impacts.
That was just a rock, Isfal said.
Steady, people.
If that Star Destroyer picks us up, it'll be over before we feel anything.
That ought to cheer them,
Cham said, and Isfal gave him one of her half-smiles, or maybe a quarter-smile. They sat in silence for a long while, hope rising with each passing minute. Soon the crew was breathing easily again.
I think that's long enough, said Cham.
Power us up, Helm.
Despite the time that had passed, the crew grew palpably tense as the systems came back online. If any Imperial ships were nearby and scanning, the freighter would light up on their sensors immediately. The lights and view screen returned, the engines engaged, and they headed up out of the rings. In moments, the rings gave way to the black of the system.
Nothing on sensors,
the engineer said. The view screen showed an empty system. The V-wings were gone, the Star Destroyer, Pock and his crew. All gone as if it had never happened.
Take us back to Ryloth, Cham ordered.
He fell in beside Isval as the ship moved out of the gravity well of the gas giant and powered up its hyperdrive.
No more half measures, he said. We stay smart, but we think bigger.
Isval locked onto the first half of his statement and echoed it back at him.
No more half measures. Aye, that, sir.
The points of stars turned to lines, and the black of space surrendered to the blue of hyperspace. Vader stood behind his master's throne in the dimly lit receiving room on Coruscant. The steady rhythm of the respirator marked the passage of the minutes. Two members of the Royal Guard, covered head to toe in the blood-red armor indicative of their order, flanked the door. Each held a stun pole at station. Vader knew that each of their crimson capes hid a heavy blaster pistol, a vibroblade, and various other weaponry. Huge windows opened out onto the Coruscant skyline, countless ships buzzing past the glass, metal, and concrete spires of the megacity. The sun threw its last light over the horizon, washing the terrain in orange and red. The Emperor sat on the throne in silence, seemingly lost in thought. But Vader, standing behind the throne, knew better. His master was never lost in thought. The Emperor's thinking ranged over time and distance in a way not even Vader fully understood, allowing him to anticipate and plan for contingencies that others did not recognize. Vader hoped to learn the technique one day, provided he didn't kill his master first. Soon after destroying the Jedi, the Emperor had told Vader that he would one day be tempted to kill him. He'd said that the relationship between Sith apprentice and master was symbiotic, but in a delicate balance. An apprentice owed his master loyalty. A master owed his apprentice knowledge and must show only strength. But the obligations were reciprocal and contingent. Should either fail in his obligation, it was the duty of the other to destroy him. The Force required it. Since before the Clone Wars, Vader's master had never shown anything but strength, and so Vader intended to show nothing but loyalty. In that way, their mutual rule was secure. Perhaps Vader would attempt to kill his master one day. Sith apprentices ordinarily did. They must, if they were trained well. An apprentice was unquestioningly loyal until the moment he wasn't. Both master and apprentice knew this.
But our relationship is different, master, Vader had said then.
Perhaps, his master had said. Perhaps.
Or maybe self-delusion was part of the training a master instilled in an apprentice.
Your thoughts are troubled, my friend,
the Emperor said, his voice loud in the quiet. The Emperor often referred to him as a friend, and perhaps they were friends in some sense, though Vader saw purpose in the use of the term. He thought his master used a term he might use with a peer to emphasize that master and apprentice were not, in fact, peers.
No, my master. Not troubled.
The Emperor chuckled, the sound coming out a cackle.
Troubled, perhaps, misstates the matter. Your thoughts are on violence.
He turned in his throne to glance back at Vader, and his eyes burned out of the shadowed recesses of his hood.
You ponder the nature of strength, do you not?
Vader never lied to his master. And he understood that his master asked questions only with great forethought, so that the answer revealed more than the words.
I do.
The Emperor turned away, showing his back to Vader, itself a calculated gesture.
Share your thoughts, my apprentice.
Vader did not hesitate.
I was thinking of the lessons you once taught me about the relationship of a Sith master to his apprentice.
And?
His master asked.
Vader dropped to a knee and bowed his head.
And I perceive strength all around me, my master.
Good, the Emperor said. Very good.
The moment having passed, Vader rose and stood stationed behind his master. Together they waited for the arrival of Orn Free Tar, the puppet delegate from Ryloth. Vader did not know the purpose of the audience. His master told him only what he needed to know. Before long, the two members of the Royal Guard, no doubt alerted to the Senator's imminent arrival via their helmet comlinks, moved to open the double doors. But before they could, the Emperor gestured with his finger and pulled the doors open with the Force. The light from the chamber beyond backlit the wide silhouette of the corpulent Twi'lek Senator. He stood there a moment as if pinioned by the Emperor's eyes, or perhaps he merely needed to work up the nerve to enter.
Come in, Senator,
the Emperor said, in the voice he used when attempting to disarm something small and weak and easily frightened.
Of course,
Tar said, waddling into the room. He eyed the guards sidelong as he passed and slowed for a moment when the doors audibly closed behind him. When he stood before the throne in his embroidered robes, he gave as much of a bow as his girth allowed.
Emperor Palpatine,
he said. Sweat glistened on his wrinkled blue skin and his gaze danced nervously between Vader and the Emperor. His wheezes were so loud, they nearly matched the sounds of Vader's respirator.
How do you fare, my friend?
The Emperor asked.
Very well,
Tar said between breaths, then quickly added,
Very well, but not so well, my Emperor, because I know the spice production on Ryloth has slowed considerably due to some unfortunate events, but...
By unfortunate events,
the Emperor said, leaning forward in his throne.
Do you mean the terrorist attacks of the Free Ryloth movement?
Tar sniffed and licked his sharpened teeth, a nervous habit. His Leku squirmed.
Yes, my Emperor. They are misled zealots and put all of my people at risk with their recklessness. But...
He paused to catch his breath before continuing.
Between the Twi'lek security forces and the Imperial troops answering to Morph Maw's, I believe matters are well in hand and that production will soon be back to full capacity.
Alas,
said the Emperor.
I do not share your optimism, Senator. Nor your high opinion of Moff Maw's.
Tar looked like he had been punched. His skin darkened. He blinked, gulped, took a half step back.
But surely...
Because I do not think matters are well in hand. I have made a decision.
Tar's eyes birthed fear, went to Vader, back to the Emperor.
My lord!
And it is this. Lord Vader and I will accompany you on an official visit to Ryloth. There we'll investigate matters for ourselves. I will notify Moff Maw's that we are coming.
Tar sagged with relief.
I don't know what to say.
You need say nothing,
the Emperor said.
The decision is made. The planning for the journey is already well in hand.
Of course.
Tar looked down as he adjusted the folds of his robes around his belly.
But me? Return to Ryloth? Perhaps I can be of more service to you here, my Emperor.
I think not,
said the Emperor.
Your presence there will be invaluable. I believe it's time the people of Ryloth were made to feel, truly feel, a part of the Empire. Do you not agree?
Oh, of course, of course,
Tar said, his chins bouncing.
You still look unconvinced, my old friend.
Tar shook his head so hard his fleshy ear flaps spread like wings.
No, no, it's just...
His voice fell to a murmur.
It's just that it's rather unpleasant there.
I'm sure you'll manage, Senator,
the Emperor said, his voice carrying the full weight of his contempt.
We'll all make the journey together, aboard the Perilous.
Tar looked up, his white face crinkled with concerns and excuses, but he seemed to think better of voicing them.
You are dismissed, Senator,
the Emperor said.
My Emperor,
Tar said with a bow.
Lord Vader!
Once the doors were closed behind him, the Emperor said to Vader,
Give me your impressions of the Senator, my friend.
He is fearful of you, as he should be, but he is not as timid as he seems. He will do as he's asked in order to preserve what power and privileges he still retains, but he will do no more than what he's asked. And he will do it all with an eye first to his own interests, then to his people, and then to the Empire.
Would you say, then, that he is loyal?
Viewed through those constraints, yes. I'd consider him loyal.
Viewed through those constraints, yes. I concur with your assessment. And so I conclude that Ornfree Tar is no traitor to the Empire.
You suspected him of treachery.
Either him or a member of his staff. He seemed an unlikely candidate, but... One never knows. Someone is providing the terrorists of the so-called Free Ryloth movement with knowledge of what transpires here. The hijacking you thwarted was indicative of that. The treason must originate in Tar's staff.
Vader should have seen the Emperor's purpose. As usual, the Emperor's thinking was one step ahead of his.
And that's why we'll travel to Ryloth. To act as bait. Why take that risk when I could simply kill Tar and his entire staff? That would eliminate the traitor.
The Emperor shook his head and stood. The moment he rose, the royal guardsmen hurried from their station at the door to flank him. Vader fell in with them as they started walking toward the chamber doors. The sun cast its final rays over the Coruscant skyline, throwing the room into deeper darkness.
But that would not eliminate the roots of the treachery,
his master said.
Nor would it reveal the scope of the treason, which I suspect reaches well beyond the Senator's staff.
I see. Then I should go alone. There's no reason to put you at risk.
But there is,
said the Emperor.
We must tear disloyalty out by the roots, expose it, and there let it wither and die where all can see.
An example to make the point.
Yes, an example for the rest of the Empire.
A needful one.
Since the consolidation of the Republic into the new Galactic Empire, pockets of chaos had appeared here and there. Most of the former Republic accepted the Empire without complaint, but there were many bands of resistance fighters and separatist remnants lurking around the galaxy. The Free Ryloth movement was one of the more capable and notorious.
Indeed,
said the Emperor.
And that lesson is one that I must administer. Besides, old friend, it has been too long since we've traveled together. Inform Morph Maws that Own Free Tar is returning to Ryloth for a state visit and that he will be traveling aboard the Perilous. She should not be informed, at least not yet, that we will be accompanying the Senator.
Yes, my master.
You have been to Ryloth before, have you not, Lord Vader?
The question dredged memories of war from the depths of Vader's mind.
Long ago, master. Before I learned wisdom.
Of course.
Chapter 3. Cham sat alone in his dimly lit quarters in one of the many underground staging camps from which he conducted his guerrilla war against the Empire. He had several such bases secreted around Ryloth. He'd spent years building his forces, cultivating his network, caching ships and weapons, laying the foundation for a major blow, and now, seemingly, an opportunity had come. More than he could have hoped for. Far more. He was sweating. He stared at the decoded message he held in his hand. Even after decryption, the message was obscure.
OFT en route W/1 and 2. Transport 1 SD. 10 DYS.
He deciphered it again, ensuring he had the right of it. Orn Free Ta was returning to Ryloth. He would be accompanied by Emperor Palpatine and Lord Vader. They were coming via Star Destroyer in 10 days. He was reading it right. It just didn't make any sense. He smelled a trap. He raised Isfahl on his comlink. He needed her take. She came promptly, a question in her eyes, and he showed her the decrypted message. She licked her lips as she read, then looked up at the wall, thinking.
Not possible, right?
He asked her.
When did this come in?
An hour ago, via the usual channels.
Trustworthy?
She asked.
The source?
Yes.
But that doesn't mean he wasn't misled.
Right, she said. A vein pulsed in her forehead. She'd had it ever since they'd heard Vader kill Pock in the hijack that had gone wrong. She handed the paper back to him. Her Leku swayed with irritation.
It's wrong or it's a trap. Has to be.
Cham crumpled the paper, burned it in the flame of the candle on his desk.
I thought so too. But what if it's not? It's an opportunity.
She sniffed, paced the floor of his room, shaking her head, her hands on the twin blaster she wore at her belt.
The Star Destroyer makes sense if they were coming. The Perilous is Vader's flagship, but why would they be coming? That's where this falls apart. And Vader and the Emperor coming to the Outer Rim? The only time they're ever in one place is on Coruscant. The why is the trouble here. We need a why.
Cham stared at the candle flame, thinking of Puck. I don't know. To make an example of Mors, maybe.
A show of force. Our attacks have slowed spice production to a trickle.
The Empire used spice, refined rill, harvested from the countless mines that made Ryloth porous, and its derivatives for countless purposes, particularly in the Imperial Science and Medical Corps.
Maybe they're coming to replace Mors,
Isval said.
With Dre, maybe. That'd be useful, but...
Cham shook his head.
No. If Mors goes down, Belcor Dre will go with her. He doesn't see that, but there's no way he stands if Mors falls.
Isval was warming to her theorizing.
Bring more stormtroopers. They've got a bunch of conscripts and enlistees here now. Nubs looking for adventure, but not true soldiers. Maybe bring more troops, elite troops, and lock down Ryloth and spice production?
Maybe, but...
One Star Destroyer. For the Emperor and Vader. It's a Star Destroyer, Cham. Think about what you're saying. Yes, but I'd wager the fleet is spread pretty thin across the galaxy,
Isval said. She'd stopped pacing and now stared at the wall, white knuckles clenched around her, hope for an opportunity to strike a telling blow.
Or maybe the Emperor's worried that a big fleet presence would send the wrong message. Make it look like he was afraid of the piddling freedom fighters of Ryloth. I need you to be the voice of reason here, Isval. I'm leaning too heavy in one direction. Yeah, but maybe you're right to do that, Isval said. Maybe you're overthinking this, Cham. When has our intelligence been wrong? There could be a dozen reasons we can't see, and if we spend all our time trying to find them, an opportunity could slip past us.
And you're underthinking it. These are clever men. If they're luring us into an overreach,
even clever men make mistakes,
she said, returning to her habitual pacing. And they have no idea of the forces at our disposal, Cham.
We've been acting like a tiny band of terrorists for years.
Freedom fighters, Cham corrected her.
Freedom fighters. But we have ships, hundreds of soldiers, heavy weapons. This is the Emperor and Vader and Tar. Vader, Cham. Think of what he did to Pock.
Cham had recurring nightmares about Pock and always woke gasping, certain he was being choked.
I don't need a reminder, Isval. But we're fighting first for a free Ryloth, not to topple the Empire.
Isval stopped pacing and stared at him.
How are they not the same thing?
What?
They're the same thing, Cham. We want a free Ryloth, then we need a toppled Empire. Or at least a weakened one. We need fires blazing all over the galaxy. Then maybe, maybe they'll leave us alone.
Cham didn't agree, but it didn't matter.
Taking out Vader and the Emperor would send the message Cham was keen to send. Ryloth is too costly to occupy, spice or no spice.
All right, he said. Let's start planning and put the cells on alert.
But don't do anything yet, Isval. I mean that.
No extra chatter.
Let's see if we hear from Belcor. If he tells me Vader and Palpatine are coming, then I'll know they're baiting us. How's that?
Belcor would never give us a shot at Vader and the Emperor unless he was told to. He's ambitious, but he's not suicidal. Isval nodded.
Makes sense.
Well then,
go get started. I'll let you know if I hear from Belcor.
Isfal nodded, gave him a half-smile, and bolted out of the room as if running a race against the fear that Cham might change his mind. Cham sat at his desk after she'd left, planning how he'd break things to Belcour. The Imperial officer was in for a rude surprise. As was his custom, Belcour Dre used the shuttle flight from Ryloth to its largest moon to square away his thinking and don the mask he wore when facing Moff Moors. He sat alone in the expansive passenger compartment and tried on the various expressions he'd wear to conceal the contempt he felt for her.
Approaching the moon now, Colonel,
the pilot said over the comm.
Let the Moff know we're on approach, Froon,
Belcour responded.
Aye, sir.
Froon was one of Belcour's men, one of the hundreds whose loyalty he'd bought through favors or secured through blackmail.
Moff Moors, lazy, sloppy, Delian Moors, left the running of Ryloth's occupation to Belcour, and Belcour had not been idle.
He'd filled several Imperial units with commanders whose first loyalty was not to Moors, or even to the Empire, but to him. And the soldiers would do exactly as their commanders told them. The stormtroopers were a problem, of course. But there weren't very many members of the Corps on Ryloth. In essence, Belcour had a shadow force at his disposal, and he'd call on it when the time was right.
Moff Belcour Dre, he said, trying out the title the same way he'd tried on false expressions.
Not Colonel, not General.
Moff.
One day. Moors would be easy to discredit, but Belcour needed to do it in a way that reflected well on himself. He had plans in the works to do just that.
Setting down, sir,
Froon said. Belcour stood up straight and checked his uniform, clean and pressed, with creases that could cut meat. Shoes shined. Insignia of rank at exact regulation distance from the edge of his collar. He removed his hat, smoothed his hair into place, and put the hat back on. Belcour took an interest in the small things, the details others missed. The practice kept him from getting sloppy, and he carried far too many secrets to allow himself any room for sloppiness. The shuttle alit on the outdoor landing pad, and Belcour pressed a button to open the door. He wrinkled his nose at the verdurous, humid air. Trees 40 meters high stood sentinel around the pad. The arm-thick ubiquitous vines so prevalent on the moon hung like a thousand nooses from the tree's thick limbs. Screeches and howls from the native fauna punctuated the air. The towering jungle canopy blocked his view of Moors's well-appointed command center, which had been built by Twillik forced labor. A young junior officer, Belcour had forgotten his name, and three stormtroopers waited on the pad. They saluted, rather sloppily in the case of the officer, as Belcour descended the ramp. Belcour returned the gesture with crispness.
The Moff was unable to greet you personally, the junior officer said.
Because she's in a spice haze, Belcour thought but didn't say, or engaged with her Twillik slaves.
I'll walk you to her.
Because she is too lazy to walk this far herself,
Belcour thought, but he said only,
Very good, Lieutenant.
A trio of V-wings on patrol cruised low overhead, the telltale and atmosphere buzz of their engines temporarily quieting the cacophony of the native animals. The moon's humidity had exacted a toll of sweat by the time Belcour and his escort reached the climate-controlled confines of Moors' luxurious command center, more akin to a noble's villa on Naboo than an imperial installation. Belcour's sweat-stained uniform fouled his mood, and he barely returned the salutes of the stormtrooper sentries on guard outside the villa's main doors. Vast windows looked out on the rolling Viridian waves of the jungle.
Rounded edges, burnished wood tables, and overstuffed chairs, divans, and lounges seemed to be everywhere, the whole of it giving the impression of softness, which fit Moors' personality precisely.
The stone sculptures so favored by Twi'leks, chunks of rock naturally carved by Ryloth's winds, as Belcore understood it, stood here and there on tables.
Twi'lek's servants moved like pale green ghosts through the rooms.
Mors chose only Twi'leks with pale green skin for her household servants. The Moth refused to call them slaves, though none could leave.
Their skin goes well with the surrounding trees, she had once said to Belcore.
The stormtroopers in the escort peeled off and took station at their interior watchposts, while the junior officer led Belcore toward the villa's open-air central courtyard, where Mors seemed to spend all her time while Belcore did all the work planetside. The courtyard was covered in a retractable clear dome to allow in ambient light. At the moment, the dome was fully retracted and hundreds of the brightly colored, hand-sized native insects, common to the top of the jungle's trees, flitted about in the air. A walking path meandered through colorful flowers, bushes, and dwarf versions of the native trees. Belcore found Mors, looking as overstuffed and soft as the villa's furnishings, seated on a bench near a fountain in the center of the courtyard, leaning into a conversation with a hut. The hut's 3-meter-long, slug-like body, covered in wrinkled, leathery skin, convulsed in something that might have been laughter. It took Belcore a great deal of effort to keep the disgust from his face. He filed the presence of the hut away in the cabinet of his mind, intending to look into travel records later. Implicating Mors in a conspiracy with the Hutts, who were engaged in any number of criminal enterprises, would give him another tool to discredit the Moth. Mors held up a finger to forestall Belcore's advance while she concluded her business with the Hut. Watching the exchange, Belcore was struck by the similarities between the two.
Both woman and alien looked like overfilled sausages. Only Mors was wrapped in a wrinkled uniform rather than leathery skin.
Her watery eyes and vaguely slack expression showed that she was in a spice haze. The Hut's watery eyes and slack expression showed that he was, in fact, a typical specimen of his kind.
Who is that? Belcore asked his escort softly.
Nashi the Hut, an envoy from Jabba.
Neither of the names meant anything to Belcore, but he filed them away, too. What does the Empire have to do with the Hutts? He asked. To that, the officer said nothing. Belcore did not press. Meanwhile, Hutt and human shared a belly laugh, the Hutt's tone unexpectedly high-pitched, and Mors gestured for Belcore and his officer escort to approach.
Come, Belcore, Mors said. Then to the officer, Lieutenant, please see that Nashi is returned to his ship. Oh, and see to it that he's given 3 cases of thin wine.
Yes, ma'am,
said the officer. Nashi turned his serpentine body fully around to face Belcore.
Before Belcore could speak, the creature belched a cloud of stink, the smell like rotting meat.
Belcore took one step back out of the cloud, but otherwise held his silence. Nashi said something over his shoulder in Huttese and chuckled. Mors shared in the chuckle and then said something in Huttese in return.
I'm afraid I don't speak the language of this alien, ma'am, Belcore said stiffly, addressing Mors.
Mors waved a hand as though it didn't matter, as though nothing mattered.
Oh, he said you look as straight and rigid as the trees.
I told him you were a young, ambitious officer and that the Academy minted all of you that way these days.
I told him he should hear you talk.
Ma'am?
Mors smiled.
Have you never heard yourself speak, Belcore? You speak as if all your words had a serif.
The Hut said something in Huttese, and the two shared another laugh. Belcore did not relax his posture.
Of course, ma'am.
Oh, don't be offended, Belcore.
Mors stood on wobbly legs and bowed to the Hut.
Safe journey, Nashi. I'll be in contact.
The Hut bowed as best a slug could manage, nodded at Belcore, then slithered off in the company of the lieutenant.
Mors lowered her weight back onto the bench.
You dislike all this,
don't you, Belcour? Belcour kept his face impassive.
Ma'am?
This,
Mors said, gesturing expansively.
This luxury. It offends you, doesn't it? It's all over your face.
Lies always came easy to Belcour.
That was the appearance of the hut, ma'am. Luxury does not offend me. With rank come privileges.
Mors smiled and leaned back on the bench, nodding.
See? There's a serif on those words. Did you hear it? Well, indeed, rank does have its privileges. We're both stationed at the ass end of the Empire, so I say we should make the most of it.
Of course, ma'am.
What about you, Belcour? You exercise few of those privileges. Will you have a wine with me?
She clapped her hands, and a pale green Twi'lek woman in a head wrap and tight-fitting tunic and trousers emerged from the nearby foliage with a ewer of wine and two goblets.
Belcour had not noticed her before.
I need to stay clear-headed for my return trip, ma'am.
Your loss,
Mors said as the slave poured.
So what brings you to my little moon, Belcour? Is all well on the planet?
The woman truly was as stupid as she was indolent.
My quarterly report on Ryloth is due, ma'am.
Is it?
Mors looked genuinely shocked. She fiddled with the tight bun of her hair for a moment.
My, time passes quickly.
Particularly when one is as busy as you are, Belcour said, and managed not to smirk.
Quite right,
Mors said. She took a gulp of wine.
If we must, we must. Proceed, Colonel. What's happening on that arid rock underneath us?
Standing throughout, Belcour went through a curated list of items that he wanted Mors to know. Staff levels, troop movements, spice shipments, and on it went. Mors asked no questions during Belcour's recital, merely nodding absently from time to time.
May I answer any questions?
Belcour asked, the words part of the exercise. Mors rarely asked anything, but Belcour needed to maintain the illusion of deference. Mors drank the last of her wine and studied the empty goblet forlornly.
There is the one thing. How do matters fare with the terrorists?
The question took Belcour aback, and he almost let his mask slip.
The Free Ryloth movement?
The terrorists,
Mors reiterated.
I have our best assets on it, ma'am,
Belcour said. Things have been quiet, planetside. It's been over a month since the last attack. Belcour had no intention of letting the quiet last another month. He'd need to feed some intel to Cham Syndulla to encourage an attack.
Belcour needed violence from the movement to give him some of the ammunition he'd ultimately use to unseat Mors, but he didn't want the violence to escalate too far while he was in charge of quelling it. Controlled violence was what he needed. Channeled violence. And he'd been using Cham to that end for months.
Mors's eyes focused more than Belcour liked to see. The woman could hold her spice, apparently.
More than a month since an attack here, Belcour. But the movement attempted to hijack a shipment of weapons not long ago. They failed, of course, but...
Belcour had heard nothing of it, from Cham or otherwise, and his ignorance alarmed him.
Where? When?
Mors waved a delicate hand.
Doesn't matter. As I said, the attempt failed. All of the terrorists were killed.
She chuckled as if she found that amusing. Belcour tread carefully. He hoped he hadn't lost Cham, or he'd have to start over with another resistance leader.
Any, familiar names among the dead?
Not that I've heard. The usual riffraff, no doubt.
Well, I wish I'd known of this sooner.
I would have doubled our efforts planetside while we had the movement back on its heels.
Do we have it on its heels?
Morris asked, looking pointedly at Belcour. Belcour shifted on his feet.
As you know, ma'am, an insurgency is hard to fight.
The resistance blends in with the non-militant populace, and killing innocents indiscriminately would only increase the number of otherwise neutral Twi'leks sympathetic to the resistance. We've made progress, but this will be a lengthy affair.
Of course,
Moore said.
Of course. I know you're doing all that can be done. And as for the failed hijacking, I only just learned of it. Oh, but as a result, Senator Ornfried Ta will be returning to Ryloth in 10 days. I only just learned that, too.
Belcour's mind immediately turned to Cham and possibilities. Why is he returning, I wonder? It's been many months since he was here last.
Who knows the minds of politicians, Belcour? But I think probably the Emperor has ordered him back to publicize the terrorists' failed hijacking. Offer support for the occupation, that kind of thing.
Reassure the non-militants, Belcour said. Show them that the terrorists are doomed to failure.
No doubt, said Moores. In any event, now you know as much as me.
And Belcour would put it to good use.
Will you be arranging his welcome personally, ma'am, or should I?
Oh, I trust you to handle it, Colonel. In my name, of course. Now, where's my wine girl?
I'll see to the preparations immediately, Belcour said. Is that all?
That'll be all.
As Belcour walked away, Moores called after him.
Belcour!
Yes.
Lighten up some, Colonel. You must learn to enjoy yourself. Oh, and if you see my wine girl, please send her to me.
Of course,
Belcour said, and took his leave, his mind spinning with possibilities. By the time he reached the shuttle, he'd narrowed them down and already had a plan in mind.
His opportunity had come. The assassination of Ornfried Ta on Morse's watch would be a fatal blow to the Moth. Ta was a powerless figurehead, of course, but he was a figurehead and mouthpiece the Emperor used as a tool when it came to quieting Ryloth.
Belcour would simply need to take care to ensure that he himself wasn't caught in the backblast of Morse's fall. Moth, Belcour, Dre sounded to him for the first time not merely aspirational, but plausible. And soon. The moment he reached his quarters planet site, he used a portable personal comm to send an encrypted message to Cham. We need to meet immediately. Cham's answer came back within the hour, naming the time and place. The speed of Cham's reply surprised Belcour. It was almost as if the Twi'lek had been expecting the message. Five hours after nightfall, Belcour stripped out of his uniform, donned civilian clothes and a hooded jacket, and logged his location in the computer as off-base recreation, a euphemism officers used when visiting with their Twi'lek mistresses or frequenting cantinas. When a duty officer saw that entry in the log, out of consideration, he asked no more questions.
Safe travel, sir, said the duty officer over Belcour's comm. It's breezy out there.
Belcour signed out an air car from the vehicle bay, entered the code that lowered the bay's force field, and exited the Imperial compound. Ryloth's capital city, Lesu, was built into and spiraled around a wind-carved stone spire as large as a mountain. The walls, villas, and more modest homesteads and businesses of the city clung like so much lichen to the face of the spire.
Thousands of reinforced tunnels and natural caves also pockmarked the stone, and seen by day, they reminded Belcour of the aftermath of an artillery barrage. The city had seen a lot of strife, as had the planet, and it showed. Dozens of air cars, a few brave souls bent against the wind on speeder bikes, and the native Ryloth kinetic gliders, wings wired to harness the gusts, coasted over and around the spire, their nighttime lights blinking or flashing in the darkness. He spotted a couple of Imperial patrol craft hovering low over the city. Belcour used Imperial craft judiciously when enforcing Imperial rule. The sight of Imperial ships sometimes upset the natives. So he left the day-to-day policing of the city to a Twi'lek security force, made up of Twi'leks co-opted by better living conditions and pay to enforce Imperial rule against their own people. He set his onboard comp to broadcast a high-level security code so he would be unbothered as he left the city's airspace. Cooking fires burned here and there in the streets and courtyards and caves below him. Even at the late hour, people and pack animals and vehicles thronged the streets, the heat and boredom bringing them outdoors. Summer brought nighttime riots to Ryloth as surely as it brought high temperatures. The heat brought crowds into the streets and cantinas, and crowds brought anger, and anger brought riots. Belcour's policy, administered in Morse's name, was to contain the riots and, as best they could manage, prevent fatalities and extensive property damage, but never to squelch them. He considered them a useful venting mechanism. Most Twi'leks fell into the middle between the satisfied collaborators and the zealots of the resistance, but almost all were occasionally resentful of the Imperial occupation. They needed an outlet for their simmering anger. Give them their riots or push them all into the Free Ryloth movement, Belcour had told Moors. In time, we'll tame them, and they'll welcome their bondage. Many already do. Moors had seen the wisdom in it. As Belcour saw it, Cham Syndulla already had enough fighters and spies in his movement. Belcour pulled back on the controls and took his air car up to cruising altitude. The surrounding landscape came into view, pale in the light of Ryloth's largest moon, where Moors dwelled. Scattered villages and towns, either walled or built mostly underground against the unrelenting winds and the planet's dangerous predators, dotted the broken rocky ground within a few kilometers of Lesu. Tough, wind-resistant scrub and the thin-trunked, flexible whip trees so common on Ryloth blanketed the jagged ground in dark patches. Movement below caught his eye. He fixed the onboard cam on the activity and magnified. A trio of huge lilacs were dismembering another smaller of their kind. The spiked pincers and powerful mandibles of the large insectoid predators moved up and down in a herky-jerky fashion, killing and cutting with a vicious efficiency that Belcour admired. No wasted effort in their slaughter. All business. Very Imperial-like, he thought. He turned westward into the face of Ryloth's winds, and the gusts fought him for control of the vehicle. Dirt and debris hit the windshield like shrapnel. He was not a good pilot, so he just white-knuckled the controls, sweating, and relied on the compensators while he flew toward the rendezvous point. Once he was well clear of Lesu's airspace, he deactivated the transmission of a security code. Out of concern for leaving traces that could be tracked after the fact, he didn't enter the coordinates for the rendezvous into the nav computer. Instead, he simply put a live readout of coordinates on the comp screen and watched them scroll by as the air car chewed up the clicks.
Chapter 4.
Belcour flew over jagged canyons, salt plateaus, and rocky valleys dotted with vast towers of stone. Huge expanses of Ryloth were uninhabited, except for the occasional isolated village or settlement that had little contact with the outside world. Herds of predators and prey filled the wild country outside the cities. The planet would have been completely irrelevant except as a source of forced labor, but for the presence of Ryl, a miracle ore with military, recreational, and scientific applications. In the distance to his right, he saw the lights of a Ryl mining operation, but the scroll of coordinates told him to keep heading west. He slowed as he flew closer to his destination, watching the coordinates count down to the designated location. He saw it ahead and below, a valley wooded in whip trees and scrub, with boulders strewn about as though cast there by giants. Caves dotted the valley walls. Cham would be in one of them. Belcour circled the valley twice, looking for Cham's ship, but saw nothing. On his second pass, an infrared beacon pinged his air car from one of the caves. "Evening, Syndulla," he said, and headed down. As he stepped out of his air car, he was accosted by the omnipresent wind and the Twi'lek woman who always seemed to be at Cham's side. Isval, he thought her name was. She stepped out of the brush, turned him roughly around, and patted him down for weapons. The look on her face was more intimidating than the twin blasters and vibroblade she wore.
"Wait a minute," he said, but she didn't, and the strength in her hands left him no doubt that resistance would be useless.
She removed his belt blaster, which was more ceremonial than anything. Belcour had fired a blaster only to qualify on the range, never in combat.
"Follow," she ordered him, "and don't speak to me."
"And who are you to—" She whirled on him, lips twisted into a snarl, revealing teeth she'd sharpened to points, something typically done only by male Twi'leks. Her fists were bunched.
"Was I unclear, Imperial? Do not speak to me."
She spun around and led him toward the cave where, presumably, Cham awaited. Having no desire to see those teeth again, he held his silence. Cham stood at the mouth of a cave, holding the infrared light, his face grim and ghostly in the night air. The wind tore at Belcour's hair, nervousness rooted in his stomach. He'd never trusted Cham, but he'd always figured Cham was not stupid. Cham knew Belcour was a traitor, to Mors, if not to the Empire, but Cham also knew that Belcour had substantial information on Cham's operations. Names, places. Belcour could hamstring the resistance if he had to, and Cham wouldn't risk that. But this meeting had a different feel to it than their previous encounters. "Let's do this right here," Belcour said. "What I have to say won't take long."
"What I have to say will,"
Cham said, switching off the infrared. He turned and started heading into the cave.
"Follow."
Laired between Isval and Cham, Belcour had little choice. He put a hand on the empty blaster holster he wore. Isval snickered.
"Eyes open,"
Cham said over his shoulder to her, and she stationed herself at the cave mouth. Belcour scurried after Cham, and they headed deeper into the cave.
"I can't see Syndulla," Belcour said, holding his hands out in front of him.
Twi'leks, who spent much of their lives underground, saw quite well in the darkness. Belcour felt as vulnerable as he ever had. He was breathing too fast, sweating. The infrared light came back on, revealing Cham directly before him, staring into his face.
"Blast!" Belcour said.
"These caves are old," Cham said. "The mountains are porous with them. My people retreated to them to form resistance bands. It's gone on cycle after cycle. The oppressor changes, but the caves remain the same."
He held the light up to the walls, which Belcour saw were covered in anti-occupation graffiti, some of it going back to the Clone Wars and earlier. "Twi'leks dislike the Jedi and Separatists as much as the Empire," Belcour said.
"We dislike yokes of any kind,"
Cham said. Behind them, a gust of wind howled across the mouth of the cave. Belcour tried to recapture some of the conversational ground he knew he'd lost.
"I'm not here for a history lesson, Syndulla."
No,
Cham said, his tone different from any of their previous dealings, more self-assured.
You're here to learn a different kind of lesson.
And how's that? Belcore asked, hoping he sounded unconcerned. He glanced back over his shoulder, thinking that the female Twi'lek was back there in the darkness somewhere, watching him. He imagined her eyes locked onto him the way predators locked eyes on prey, and his mind flashed on the lilacs he'd seen on his flight there, dismembering the smaller, weaker one. He cleared his throat and pushed the image out of his mind. The tunnel snaked left. An orange glow lit an open space ahead. Within the sand-floored chamber was a simple wooden table with two chairs set beside it. Nothing else, just the table.
Are we playing hollow chess, Syndulla?
We've been playing hollow chess for years, Belcore. And you lost. You just didn't realize it. But you're about to. Sit. We're going to be honest with each other now. Completely honest.
That sounds ill-advised,
Belcore said, an attempt to joke away his growing concern. The dry air pulled the moisture from his mouth. He slipped into the seat opposite Cham.
The Twi'lek's orange skin was flushed, his leku swaying slightly, his eyes on Belcore's.
Belcore had to work to answer Cham's gaze. Are you on the spice, Syndulla? I think maybe you misunderstand our relationship, as does your girl out there. I'm not the one working for you. You're working for me. I can forgive a slip-up once, but...
Cham held up a hand, his brow furrowed with anger, and Belcore stuttered into silence.
Honesty, I said,
Cham said.
I'll start. You're here to tell me that Ornfree Tar is returning to Ryloth on a state visit in 10 days.
I... Belcore stopped himself and regathered his words.
You have excellent spies.
More than you know. He'll be aboard a Star Destroyer. The Pedalus.
Belcore sat back in his chair, sweating, studying Cham, affecting indifference, but he feared doing a poor job of it.
And?
Cham leaned forward in his chair, his hands gripping the edge of the table. He stared into Belcore's face.
And I see you, Belcore. Do you see me?
What? I don't...
What?
Belcore felt off balance, and sure, he must look ridiculous.
I've always seen you,
Cham said.
You thought I was dancing to your song this whole time, yes? You thought you were playing me. You're a child, Belcore.
Belcore blinked in the face of Cham's assuredness. He tried to summon words, found none, tried to summon his dignity, found it wanting. He stood on shaky legs.
Our relationship is over. I'm leaving.
No, you're not. Sit down, Belcore Dre. Sit.
Belcore swallowed, felt his face color with anger and fear.
What are you going to do? Kill me!
I've taken steps.
If anything happens to me...
You have agents who'll kill me? A lie, Belcore. You'd trust no one enough to let them know about our relationship. Oh, I know you've got men loyal to you and not Moors all over the planet, but you wouldn't tell them about us, or they wouldn't be loyal anymore, now would they? The fact that you have those forces is what makes you interesting to me. I have forces too, Belcore. The two of us, we make quite a pair.
A data disk,
Belcore said, his tone high-pitched, his speech rapid.
In the event of my death, it identifies you, the location of many of your bases, your people. It'll go out to everyone who needs to know.
Cham smirked.
Now that, I believe. But it changes nothing. You don't know a half of what there is to know about my network, Belcore. That disc would be a blow, but not a mortal one.
The Twi'lek said nothing for a moment, seemingly to allow Belcore to process his claims. Belcore didn't know what to make of them. Lies? Truth?
he couldn't say.
Cham's tone changed to somber. Besides,